Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Our lesson tonight is from the 14th chapter of the book of Genesis. If you have your Old Testament, open it there. We shall consult some information that's revealed here for our background. By the time we get to the 14th chapter of Genesis, we have, of course, the inspired historical record of the creation. We have been told about the events that had taken place in the Garden of Eden. We also have the record of the worship of Cain and Abel, one acceptable, one unacceptable. We even see how that the whole world had become so wicked that God had the purpose to destroy it, saving for Noah and his family, 8 souls, as they were saved in the ark, and how they came out of the ark. And a little bit later on, we read about the occasion of the Tower of Babel. Then we read of the call of Abraham, God calling him out of the Ur of Chaldees to go to a land that he had told him, and promises that God gave unto Abraham, which I shall mention momentarily. And in the chapter immediately preceding the one that's under consideration tonight, we have seen the choice, the foolish choice that Lot had made when the land, the Lot was being Abraham's nephew, the land being unable to sustain them both because they were so prosperous, Lot chose to cast his lot toward Sodom. And that proved to be a very foolish choice on his part. Now God made some great promises to Abraham. He promised him that he would make his name great. He promised him that he would be a father of a great nation. So much so that his descendants would be as the sands of the sea and as the stars of the heavens and as even the dust of the ground. He also promised him that he would bless those that blessed him and curse those that cursed him. But the greatest promise, and he also, by the way, promised that his descendants would have a land that would be theirs, the land of Canaan. That is, at least, until the fulfillment, the accomplishment of the purposes for which God was choosing this man and his descendants. And the greatest promise that God made to Abraham was that through him and in thy seed shall all nations or all families of the earth be blessed. Which the Apostle Paul said was a promise of the coming of Christ in Galatians 3 and verse 16. Now, when you read of these promises in Genesis 12, Genesis 18, other chapters of the book of Genesis, from that time forward, everything else in the Bible is God's inspired record of God keeping the promises that he made to Abraham. And the Bible is a series of historical records and the events that took place in the accomplishment of that nation and in the ultimate bringing of Christ to the world. Everything pertaining to that point, from that point on, has to focus upon those promises. Now in Genesis chapter 14 that we shall study tonight, there is an event that takes place that is a part of the historical record concerning the life of Abraham that shows us certain things, by the way, of the character and the nature of Abraham and his relationship with God. But also an event that took place that teaches us something concerning the Christ that was to come many, many years later. Now the land of Canaan was inhabited when Abraham came into it. And we read about how that the people of the various cities in the land of Canaan were hostile at times, one against the other. Inhabitants of one city would go to war against the inhabitants of another. And chapter 14 tells us about 4 kings going to war against 5 kings. Now, to call them kings, it's proper because that's what they were called, but we get the concept maybe today of a king, of one who rules a great domain, a vast empire, maybe like the king of England or used to be the king of France and other places like that. But these kings of these cities were more or less the main ruler of the city. We might even call him the mayor of the city. Maybe he had more authority than that. He has the real power of a rather small area. And it happened that four of these kings had war with five of these kings. And the four kings that were allied together defeated the five kings that were allied together. And among the kings that were defeated were kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. And our focus and interest is particularly upon the king of Sodom, because this was now the ill-chosen home of Lot. And this would affect Abraham, because it was going to affect Lot. And the kings that were victorious took the spoils of the city of Sodom. They took materials from Sodom. They took a number of the people as captives out of Sodom. And among those that were taken as captives was Lot and his family. Well, we read in verse 12 how that they took Lot, and in verse 13, messengers came to tell Abraham about what had taken place. Now, Abraham had some friends in the area, their names are Mamre, Eshcol, and Anar, but they were not of the four kings, they were not a part of the five kings, they were obviously friends of Abraham. But it is recorded here that they came and told Abram the Hebrew about what had happened to Lot. Let me digress from the event that takes place momentarily to focus our attention just now on the word Hebrew. The word Hebrew simply means, literally, to come from beyond, or one who has passed over. And it had reference here to Abraham, who had come from beyond, way over in the land of Ur of Chaldees. He had passed over the prominent rivers of Tigris and Euphrates in order to come into the land that eventually God would give to his descendants. And so this is the first time in the Bible that we read the word Hebrew. And Abraham is called a Hebrew. And his descendants are referred to as Hebrews. Now, later on, after Abraham, there was Isaac, his son, and Isaac's son was Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons that became the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And Jacob's name was changed by God to Israel, and therefore all of the descendants of Jacob were called Israelites. And so, the Hebrews would be the descendants of all of Abraham's descendants, which would be more than just Jacob's family. But these people, the promised people, the one through whom the Messiah was to come, it's narrowed down now somewhat to be the Israelites. Well, if you're aware, and I call your attention to your memory back to the history of the Israelite people, how that they were in bondage, were delivered, did wander through the wilderness, did take the land of Canaan, were ruled by judges, were ruled by a united kingdom, then were ruled in a divided kingdom, and eventually carried off into captivity. The northern area, into a captivity from which they never returned as a nation. The southern kingdom, called Judah, went off into captivity for 70 years and returned. Those that returned of the tribe of Judah, of that nation, began to be called Jews. I suppose, taking it from the term Judah. And so we see Abraham's descendants first being called Hebrews, and then, through the promised lineage, Israelites, and then even more narrow than before, the Israelites that were called the Jews. And though they might well refer to the same person, they wouldn't necessarily have to apply to the same person. But all Jews had been Israelites, and all Israelites had been Hebrews, but not all Hebrews were Israelites, and not all Israelites were Jews. And you'll have to get the tape to unravel that. But Jesus was a Jew. Now, when you come to the time of the New Testament, the term Hebrew or Israelite or Jew are more or less used interchangeably. there's no real distinction. And the reason for that is, by the time you come to the New Testament and to Christ, especially after the destruction of Jerusalem, which was impending, why all of those kind of distinctions were erased. And that's just a passing point, I think, of interest concerning those identifications. Now, it says that they came to Abram and told him that his brother was taken captive. Actually, Lot was his nephew. But he was his kinsman. That's what this term brother here means. And it is likened unto that back over in chapter 13 when Abraham said that we're not going to have trouble between us over the land, for we be brethren. And so this touched the heart of Abraham, who is still at this time simply referred to as Abram, because he grieved over the fact, obviously, that his kinsman had been taken captive. And notice what he does. He was obviously a man of action. He called out his own servants, some 318 of them. He must have been a very prosperous man to have had that kind of core of people in his servitude. And he armed these 318 men. He developed for himself here his own private army. And he, along with these friends that I have mentioned back up here, that are named in verse 13, they went in pursuit of the king that had taken Lot and his family and others off as captives. Now this tells us something about Abraham, that he was not only a man of faith. As I said, he was a man of action. He was obviously a man of courage. He was obviously a person of conviction. He was obviously one who had a great tie with those who were his brethren. And all of these things are very commendable of this man that does have the unique distinction of being called, in the second chapter of James, the friend of God. I don't know how you would speak of one in more glowing terms than to speak of one as a friend of God. But such was said of Abraham. And he went after these people, and he defeated them. He recovered the goods that they had taken, and he delivered and recaptured or brought back Lot and other inhabitants that had been taken because of the loss in that warfare. Now, on his way back, after having won this victory, he meets two people. And there's something significant about both of these meetings. One of them that he meets is the king of Sodom, which we're going to consider first, which has no relevance to the immediate situation, which does tell us something about the nature of Abraham. But the other that he meets is a man called Melchizedek. We'll talk about Melchizedek just briefly in a moment. But now when he comes to meet the king of Sodom, and you read about him meeting the king of Sodom in verse 17, but you skip down to verse 21 to read the record of their meeting. When they met, the king of Sodom was delighted, of course, as you can imagine. And he simply said to Abraham, "You give me the people back that had been taken, and all the material spoils that you have recaptured, why, you keep that for yourself." It must have been a sizable accomplishment to have won this victory. And there might have been a considerable amount of goods involved here. But the king of Sodom said, and I think he was certainly every indication of good faith, every indication of wanting to be fair. "You have risked yourself, you have risked your men, you've undertaken this event, and you have been victorious. It's nothing but right that the material goods, though they were taken from us, you have recaptured them. It is nothing but right that they belong to you. Just give me back the people." But Abraham would not take those goods. He would not receive any of the materials. And he gave this as this reason. In verse 23, "That I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. Now, I want you to notice, this goes back a little bit. Who was it that had promised Abraham that he would be great? It was God. Who was it that promised Abraham to be a father of a great nation? That was God. Who was it that had promised that I'll bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you? That was God. Who had given all of these bountiful blessings in prospect to Abraham? It was God. Abraham believed those things. Abraham's faith and trust and confidence was in God, not in what some man could give him. Furthermore, Abraham was exceedingly cautious and obviously very wise to refuse to take these things from the hand of the king of Sodom, lest it could be said someone other than God had caused Abraham to prosper. And Abraham wanted no part of that. Abraham didn't want it to even be said or insinuated or suggested that his bounty and his prosperity and his success came from any other source than the true and living God of heaven. And therefore he would not take of the goods of the king of Sodom. And that tells us something of the faith and trust and confidence that Abraham had, and his wisdom as well. Now, he did suggest that the king of Sodom allow some of these men that had gone with him to at least take sufficient to recover the supplies that they might have used in the warfare. If he wanted to give them something, all right. But he wouldn't take anything for himself from this accomplishment. Well, so much for the meeting with the king of Sodom. The more significant meeting on the return of victory was his meeting with this man called Melchizedek. Notice verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him, that is, Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand. And he, that's Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, tithes of all. Now, Abraham didn't give everything back to the king of Sodom, did he? He gave a tithe, 10% of it, to Melchizedek. Now, what's the significance of this? The significance of it, dear people, is when you come to the book of Hebrews, a book that was written to people who had once been of the Judaistic faith, had been converted to Christianity. Some of them were being tempted to go back into Judaism. Some of them had already fallen and had gone back into Judaism. And the book of Hebrews was written to these Jewish Christians to show the folly of them casting off the superior for the inferior. The book of Hebrews shows the superiority of Christ. It's a book of the exaltation of Christ, the exaltation of the priesthood of Christ and the law of Christ, superior to Moses, superior to the Levite priesthood, superior to angels, superior to anything and everything that had ever gone on before, to show that he was the one that God had promised, even unto Abraham, that would be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. And the book of Hebrews tells us, in talking about the priesthood of Christ, Hebrews chapter 7 goes into this in somewhat detail, that Christ would be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. In other words, it would be likened unto Melchizedek. Melchizedek, therefore, that Abraham met way back here in the book of Genesis, was a type, a pre-picture, a symbol, a representation of the one that was to come. That was Christ. And the same Holy Spirit that tells us about this particular event also tells us that Christ was to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now we can learn something about Christ when we learn something about Melchizedek. And it's not our purpose tonight. I have, in times past, I believe, preached a lesson entirely and exclusively about the nature and the characteristics of Melchizedek, and I'm not going into all of those details tonight. But tonight we simply want to take note, first of all, Melchizedek was king and priest at the same time. When Abraham met him, he was king of Salem and priest of God. And friend, that's the nature and the characteristic of the priesthood of Christ. He is not only our high priest, Hebrews 3 and verse 1, he is also king, ruling over his kingdom. And that is of special significance in view of the fact that there is this false doctrine that though it was prophesied that Christ would establish his kingdom, he came, and because the Jews rejected him, he postponed it and did not establish his kingdom, but established a substitute measure, which is called the church. That's an ingredient in the doctrine of premillennialism. And it's false, because the church is not something as a substitute for the kingdom. The church is the kingdom. When we read of the prophecies of the Old Testament concerning the coming of the kingdom and the fulfillment of those prophecies in the New Testament, what do you have established? It is the church. Those that were in the church were said to be in the kingdom. Those in the kingdom were in the church. Those in the church were in the kingdom. It refers to the same group of people. And it's highly significant that the church is the kingdom, because when Jesus comes again, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 24, he is going to deliver up the kingdom, which is the church. And here's the reason to be in the church. He's going to deliver up the church or the kingdom to the Father. And that's the company of people in which we ought to belong, is it not? The ones that Jesus will deliver to the Father. So Christ is king now. He has established his kingdom. His kingdom was established on the first Pentecost after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And Christ is a priest after the order of this man, who was priest and king at the same time. But maybe of even greater significance than that is the fact that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And the book of Hebrews points out that the greater blesses the lesser. Abraham, in this case, therefore, would have been the lesser of the two. Melchizedek would have been the greater of the two. Now, why would that be significant? Well, before we explain why that's significant, please take note that Abraham paid tithes unto Melchizedek. And indeed, the lesser gives tithes to the greater. So in this way, the fact that Melchizedek blessed Abraham and Abraham made tithes to Melchizedek, it is established concretely that Melchizedek was considered to be of superiority even over the great friend of God. Now the real significance of that is seen in this. As we noted, after Abraham came Isaac. After Isaac came Jacob. After Jacob there were the 12 tribes. One of the 12 sons was named Levi. And under the system that God gave the Israelites through Moses was a priesthood that was to be taken from the tribe of Levi, the Levitical priesthood. They were special and unique among all the people of Israel, and they supplied all the priestly services. In fact, the family of Aaron, who was of the tribe of Levi, supplied the high priest. Now the significance then is this. Keep in mind how that the book of Hebrews exalts Christ. It is designed to show the superiority of Christ. The folly of ever abandoning Christ for former systems, even a system that once had been given by God. One should follow Christ. And in the process of doing this, the writer of Hebrews shows the priesthood of Christ to be superior to the priesthood of the Levitical priesthood. And he does it in this way, by declaring here in Hebrews that even the Levites paid tithes to Melchizedek because they were still in the loins of Abraham, Abraham being their great-grandfather, they being descendants of this man that paid tithes to Melchizedek, even that priesthood through Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. The lesser paid tithes to the greater. Christ is after the order of Melchizedek. Therefore, Christ is superior to the Levitical tribe. The priesthood of Christ is superior to the tribe of the Judaistic system. The system, of course, that Paul repeatedly shows, been nailed to the cross and taken out of the way, having accomplished its purposes, and was only to last until Christ came. Therein, my dear people, is the significance of this event that took place so many, many years, about 2,000 years, even before Christ came to the earth. And here's something we see in all of this. Way back here in the dealings with Abraham and in this historical event that took place, God was gradually unfolding, gradually revealing, gradually developing, although it was already developed in his own mind, gradually making known his plan for saving men through Jesus Christ. And it shows the unity of the Scriptures, how that the same God that was the God of Abraham that caused this particular event here to take place with Melchizedek was the God who is the Father of the Christ. God's hand was in it all. Even all the way back to Abraham, in fact, even back to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. But we're dealing with this. All the way back with Abraham, God guided, designed, delivered, revealed, brought into being his plan. All down through the ages, God's hand was in it all. And one of the evidences that Jesus of Nazareth, born of the Virgin Mary, is the Christ, is because he accomplished and he fulfilled these prophecies that had been given literally hundreds, nearly thousands of years before. And you can see how that one mind was behind the entire operation by this event that took place when Abraham defeated the kings and returned and met Melchizedek. Melchizedek is a very unique individual. There are certain things said of him, particularly in the book of Hebrews, that have caused some great concern about people, or with some people about him. But the purpose of Melchizedek was similar to the purpose of the Passover lamb. The Passover lamb also was a type of Christ. The purpose of Melchizedek was similar to the work of Moses, being the great deliverer and lawgiver, another type of Christ. There are so many things in the Old that we see them come to fruition, we see them come to light when we read these things in the New. So this event here is not just a record of history for historical interest, though it is of interest. It's not just to tell us what happened to Lot and then what Abraham did about it, though that is a part of it, and that had an immediate relevance to the events of this particular chosen family. Even this event here is recorded so that we can read of the exaltation of Jesus the Christ. That's what the Bible emphasizes. Christ is the central personality of it all. And it puts Christ upon a pedestal that is above every name and every law. And folks, when we come to understand how that the Bible does exalt the Christ and how God the Father has exalted Christ, and when we come to the appreciation of the greatness of the Son of God, then we are motivated and prompted and encouraged to want to give our lives to him. We see his greatness, we want to follow him. We see his majesty, we see his kingship, his priesthood, we want to be Christians. We want to be obedient and submissive. We want to partake of the benefits. We want to be among those of the family of the earth that are going to be blessed through this great and wonderful seed of Abraham, which is Jesus the Christ. Well, such is the lesson for tonight, and it has many historical matters in it that is of interest and sure and ties all of them together. But the most important matter of the 14th chapter of the book of Genesis is to see the greatness, the superiority of Jesus the Christ. If you have an appreciation for that truth and have not yet come to Him, won't you do as Christy did this morning, Christy Farless? She came to confess her faith in Christ and to be baptized into Christ. This is what the Bible teaches that we must do. This is how we show our love and appreciation for this great one, of whom even Genesis 14 speaks in prospect. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, as the Bible so clearly affirms, will you not turn your steps, will you not turn your life, will you not turn your direction toward Him, away from all of that which is contrary to the will of God, and to submit yourself to being a follower of Christ? Will you not boldly, as Christy did, confess your faith and obey Him in baptism, where the blood of Christ is applied to your sin-stained soul and you are raised to walk in the newness of life, a child of God, being one of the blessed through the family of Abraham? If you've once done that and you've not walked faithfully before Him, you need to be restored. Friend, if you're going to heaven, you must be restored. It's that important. Repentance, confession, and prayer is God's plan for the way for you to be restored into the good fellowship of your brethren and with God. Brother Reed now is going to lead us in the song of invitation, God is calling the prodigal. You're away from home when you're away from Christ, but the Father awaits, and you can come because He's provided the way for you to come. And we would plead with you to do that, to let it be known tonight.